Welcome back to the program. In the 1960s, the activists that were part of the free speech movement at Berkeley really believed that the FBI was spying on them, that the FBI had infiltrated them and was trying to embarrass and undermine their efforts. All of this was denied at the time. Today, we know better. While working as an investigative reporter for the San Francisco Examiner and the San Francisco Chronicle, Seth Rosenfeld sued the FBI four times over the past 30 years to obtain confidential records under the Freedom of Information Act regarding the agency's covert activities at UC Berkeley during the 60s. Eventually, he compelled the FBI to release more than 250,000 pages from their files. In his new book, Subversives, he painstakingly recreates the dramatic and unsettling history of how J. Edgar Hoover worked closely with then-California Governor Ronald Reagan to undermine student dissent and arrest and expel members of the Berkeley free speech movement, and finally, to fire the University of California president, Clark Kerr. In Subversives, Rosenfeld reveals how the FBI's counterintelligence program took tactics that were originally developed for use against foreign adversaries during the Cold War and turned them on domestic groups whose politics Hoover found un-American. Seth Rosenfeld's work has earned him a George Polk Award, a First Amendment Award from the Society of Professional Journalists, as well as Harvard University's Goldsmith Prize for Investigative Reporting. It is my pleasure to welcome Seth Rosenfeld here to talk about Subversives, the FBI's war on student radicals and Reagan's rise to power. Seth Rosenfeld, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Delight to have you here. Why did Hoover care about what was going on in the free speech movement at Berkeley?
J. Edgar Hoover had long been concerned about the University of California. During World War II and right after World War II, the FBI investigated Soviet espionage attempts to gather secrets about nuclear weapons being produced at UC. UC had helped develop the bombs that ended World War II. But in the years after that, these FBI records show that Hoover turned his focus from Soviet espionage agents to professors and students engaged in dissent. And when the free speech movement erupted in 1964, J. Edgar Hoover viewed this as further evidence of a communist plot to disrupt the nation's campuses.
One of the things about the free speech movement that he was particularly concerned about were some of its leaders, including Mario Savio, who he found particularly dangerous.
Yes. Mario Savio was one of the earliest and most prominent figures in the student movement. He's a fascinating figure. He was born in New York in 1942, was raised in a devoutly Catholic family, and he believed that he would be a priest when he grew up. But in high school, Savio began to question church dogma. He studied science and philosophy and came to have great doubts about the religious faith. But he still had this powerful drive to do good in the world, and he turned that energy to the civil rights movement and devoted himself to that. Savio was a brilliant student. He was his valedictorian and had a grade point average of 96.6, the IQ of 159. He went to the South in the summer of 1964 to help register blacks to vote. And when he returned to campus that fall, he was shocked to find that a rule prohibited him and other students from handing out leaflets on campus for the civil rights movement or handing out any other kind of leaflets, even leaflets for Goldwater for president, who was the nominee that year at the Republican National Convention in San Francisco. Well, the students began to protest this rule, and one morning they set up a card table on Sproul Plaza in the center of the UC Berkeley campus, and in defiance of the rule, began to hand out leaflets. The campus police drove a police car right onto the campus quad and began to arrest a student named Jack Weinberg, who was at one of these tables. And before they could drive off, the students sat down around the car, and soon there were hundreds of students surrounding the car and filling up the whole plaza. And they held the car captive for the next 33 hours. And that was how the free speech movement was born in September of 1964. Savio soon emerged as the most prominent spokesperson for the free speech movement. He had a terrible stutter when speaking to people in small groups. He'd been afflicted by this stutter since he was a small child. But when Savio was speaking to a large group of people, when he was addressing what he saw as an abuse of power by the campus administration, he spoke with a divine fire that inspired people to join the free speech movement.
Talk about Clark Kerr, who was the president of the university, who was certainly a liberal, who had been responsible for creating California's master plan for education, and his sense of what was going on there, why he didn't have a better sense of seeing this coming, because this really caught him by surprise.
Yes. Clark Kerr is one of the towering figures in American higher education. He was born on a farm in Pennsylvania. Yeah, worked on a farm when he grew up. He attended a one-room schoolhouse as a boy where a teacher took an interest in him and helped him become a good student. He went on to Swarthmore College where he joined the Quaker faith and found that education was this transforming process. Later, when he came to the University of California as the first chancellor of Berkeley, he did everything he could at that time to open the campus to free speech. Kerr once said, "The university is not engaged in making ideas safe for students. It's engaged in making students safe for ideas." What he meant by that was that if students were properly educated, they would have the ability to hear views from all sides and make the right decision. So Kerr liberalized campus rules. He lifted a ban against communist speakers on campus. He lifted another ban that prohibited politicians of any kind from appearing on campus. Back in the 40s and 50s, when Adlai Stevenson was campaigning and he wanted to speak to Berkeley students, he had to do so from across the street because the campus rules prohibited him from actually speaking on campus. So Kerr opened the campus to more free speech. But he later said he didn't appreciate how involved students like Mario Savio were committed to, how involved they were and how committed they were to the civil rights movement. He did not appreciate the passion and commitment. The other problem for Kerr was that by this time he was president of the entire University of California system and all nine campuses. The Berkeley campus was actually run by Chancellor Ed Strong, and Kerr initially deferred to Ed Strong's decision to enforce the ban against political activity on campus. Kerr later said he regretted that he had been too slow to appreciate the importance of the free speech movement.
Talk a little bit about Hoover having Clark Kerr sort of in his sights even before this explosion with the free speech movement had happened.
J. Edgar Hoover had been suspicious about Clark Kerr for a long time. As a Quaker, Clark Kerr was opposed to mandatory oaths and spoke out about them. And this caught Hoover's attention and made him view Clark Kerr as somebody who was not in complete accord with the FBI's view. And when Kerr liberalized the campus rules for political activity, J. Edgar Hoover saw this as further evidence that Kerr was not trustworthy. In 1960, several UC Berkeley students were part of a protest at San Francisco City Hall against the House Un-American Activities Committee. Some people demanded that Clark Kerr expel the students. Kerr refused. He said, "What the students do off campus on their own time is their affair, not the university's." This infuriated J. Edgar Hoover, and he wrote in a memo to his aides, "I know Kerr is no good." When the free speech movement happened in 1964, J. Edgar Hoover was even more furious, and he ordered his agents to take steps to get Clark Kerr fired as the University of California president. He did this by leaking false reports about Clark Kerr associating with allegedly subversive characters to members of the Board of Regents who he hoped would fire Clark Kerr. But at that time, Pat Brown was the governor of California, and he was a strong supporter of Clark Kerr, and the Board of Regents refused to fire Clark Kerr at that time.
I want to back up a little bit and talk about how you came to this story, how you got your teeth into it initially, a story that you'd spent 30 years working on.
I first got interested in FBI activities at the University of California when I was a student at UC Berkeley's Journalism School in 1981. The Daily Californian student newspaper had obtained some FBI records under the Freedom of Information Act, and the editor asked me to take a look at them. I studied those records and wrote some stories for the Daily Cal about the FBI spying on the free speech movement, but I realized there was more to the story, so I submitted a greatly expanded Freedom of Information Act request. I thought I would get the records in about a year, write up the story, and move on to the next project. I had no idea I was embarking on what would be a 30-year legal odyssey in which I would bring several lawsuits that would compel the FBI to release more than 250,000 pages of documents, and that the FBI would spend more than $1 million trying to suppress these records and keep them from becoming public.
And in fact, it took 4 or 5 lawsuits for you ultimately to get all of the records that you got.
That's correct. I ultimately brought 5 lawsuits challenging the FBI's failure to release this information. The FBI redacted so much information on some pages that you couldn't even see. You couldn't even tell what the documents were about. So with the help of pro bono attorneys, we challenged these redactions, and ultimately the courts ordered the FBI to release much more information. The courts also found that the FBI's investigation of the free speech movement had turned into unlawful political surveillance. The FBI had tried to withhold the information on the ground that it was for a law enforcement purpose. But after the courts examined those records, they found that though the FBI may have initially been investigating the free speech movement to see if it was engaged in unlawful activity, that the FBI soon became aware that it was really just a student protest against a campus rule, and the FBI had kept investigating it for unlawful political surveillance. The courts also found that the FBI's efforts to get Clark Kerr fired were improper and an abuse of its powers.
One of the other things that you uncovered as a result of all of this is the degree to which the FBI, in fact, infiltrated these student groups and engaged in dirty tricks. Talk a little about that.
J. Edgar Hoover's FBI went beyond surveillance and investigating the free speech movement and the anti-war movement in Berkeley to using the information it had gathered to try and disrupt and neutralize, as the FBI put it in its own documents, the students and the professors who were involved in these First Amendment activities. One way J. Edgar Hoover's FBI did this was by leaking allegations about the students to a local newspaper reporter named Ed Montgomery, who was then a reporter for the San Francisco Examiner. The FBI gave Montgomery allegations that the students were part of a communist plot, and Montgomery wrote a front-page series of articles that created quite a controversy about the student protests, and in the eyes of some people, discredited the student protests. When I interviewed Mario Savio and Clark Kerr about that years later, they said that these articles had a negative effect because they heightened suspicion of the university and made it harder for the students and the administration to try and negotiate an end to the protests.
One of the people that the FBI had infiltrated was Richard Aoki. Talk about who he was and what his role was in this.
Richard Aoki is a fascinating character. He was born in San Leandro, California in 1938. At the age of four, he was interned with thousands of other Japanese Americans. Released after World War II, he returned to his neighborhood in West Oakland, where he grew up in what was essentially a poor black community. He became involved in street crime and had numerous arrests by the police. And at the same time, was a very bright person. He was a co-valedictorian in junior high school. Soon after he graduated from Berkeley High School, his family had moved to Berkeley at this point, he was approached by the FBI and asked to become an informant. And according to hundreds of pages of FBI records released to me as a result of one of the lawsuits I brought, Rich Aoki went on to become an FBI informant for 16 years, from 1961 through 1977. And according to these records, he was a paid FBI informant at the time he armed the Black Panthers in 1966 and 1967. He had met Huey Newton and Bobby Seale when he was a student, actually when they were all students, at Merritt Community College in Oakland. And when Bobby Seale and Huey Newton formed the Black Panther Party in late 1966, they consulted with Richard Aoki. And he later gave them some of their first guns and firearms training in late 1966 and 1967. This revelation that Richard Aoki was a paid FBI informant has come as a bit of a shock to people who knew him, because he was widely revered as a militant radical leader in Berkeley during these years. And nobody had any idea he was actually also informing for the FBI at the same time.
What did the FBI know about his activities on a day-to-day basis?
The FBI records show that FBI agents were in regular contact with Richard Aoki, and that they considered the information that he provided to be of great value. These records indicate that he was informing on a wide variety of groups, including the Socialist Workers' Party, the Vietnam Day Committee, the Black Panthers, the Asian American Political Alliance, and the Third World Liberation Front strike at UC Berkeley in 1969. For more ethnic studies. What we don't know is what the FBI knew about Richard Aoki giving the Black Panthers guns, and we don't know if the FBI had any involvement in his arming the Black Panthers.
Is there any way that we'll ever know that, do you think?
Well, I'm continuing my investigation, and I hope to get more information about Richard Aoki's work as an FBI informant. We do know that during the same period, J. Edgar Hoover's FBI was trying to destroy the Black Panther Party, and that the FBI used many informants inside the Black Panther Party. And we also know that by 1969, several dozen Black Panthers had been involved in shootouts with police officers around the country, and that both Panthers and police officers were killed as a result of that. So the fact that Richard Aoki was a paid FBI informant at the time he armed the Black Panthers raises some very serious questions about what the FBI knew and whether it was involved. And we hope to find out those answers.
One of the other major turning points in all of this was ultimately the California Board of Regents firing Clark Kerr. This happened when changes were made as a result of the election of Ronald Reagan as governor. Talk about that.
One of the there are actually three main characters in my book, Subversives. One of them is Mario Savio. Another one is Clark Kerr. And the third one is Ronald Reagan. And what I found through FBI documents was that the FBI had a special relationship with Ronald Reagan going back to Hollywood in the 1940s. these FBI records provide the most detailed view of Ronald Reagan's relationship with the FBI that we've ever had. Previous biographers were thwarted in examining this because the FBI had withheld so much of this information. What we now know is that Ronald Reagan became an FBI informant in Hollywood in 1946, and that he was more involved as an FBI informer than previously disclosed.
The FBI originally came to him.
One night in 1946, FBI agents knocked on the door of Ronald Reagan's home in Hollywood and told him that communists were infiltrating some liberal groups that he was involved in. As Reagan later wrote, this opened my eyes to a good many things. The FBI documents that have been released to me now flesh out what happened next. And they show Ronald Reagan reported to the FBI the names of fellow actors whom he suspected of being communists or subversive, sometimes on the scantiest of evidence. And that later, when Ronald Reagan became president of the Screen Actors Guild in Hollywood, the FBI had wide access to guild records on dozens of actors. Years later, the FBI repaid this favor to Ronald Reagan by giving him secret personal and political help.
Talk about the way in which the FBI gave him that help.
Well, the FBI gave... J. Edgar Hoover's FBI gave Ronald Reagan personal and political help over an extended period of time. In one example, in 1960, Ronald Reagan and his former wife, the actress Jane Wyman, were concerned about their eldest daughter, Maureen Reagan. She was then just 19 years old, and she had moved to Washington, D.C. They had heard a rumor that she was living with an older married police officer. The Reagans turned to the FBI for help in finding out what was going on with their daughter. J. Edgar Hoover personally authorized an investigation into the romantic life of Maureen Reagan, even though FBI officials acknowledged in their documents that this was beyond the FBI's jurisdiction. So one FBI agent posed as an insurance salesman and questioned neighbors. Another agent questioned the housekeeper at Maureen Reagan's boarding house, and another FBI agent contacted the police department, and they confirmed that she was in fact living with an older married police officer. And they reported this information back to Ronald Reagan. In another example of the FBI giving Reagan personal and political help, in 1965, the FBI had a massive investigation into the Bonanno crime family. And during this investigation, agents discovered that Ronald Reagan's eldest son, Michael Reagan, was hanging out with the son of Joe Bonanno, the head of the Bonanno crime family. The agents wanted to interview Ronald Reagan to see if he had heard anything from his son that might be useful to their investigation. But J. Edgar Hoover interceded. He blocked them from interviewing Ronald Reagan about the Bonannos, and instead ordered agents to warn Reagan that his son Michael was hanging out with Joe Bonanno's son. In one of the most interesting documents that was released to me, an FBI agent describes how grateful Ronald Reagan was to receive this information. According to this document, Reagan said he realized how damaging this information could be to his political aspirations if it became public, and that he realized it would be unwise to thank J. Edgar Hoover in writing. So he instead asked the agent to convey his great appreciation to J. Edgar Hoover, and he promised to keep it confidential. This personal and political help continued after Reagan became governor of California. In January of 1967, very soon after Ronald Reagan was elected and took office, he phoned the FBI and asked for a secret briefing about student protests at UC Berkeley, and also about liberal members of the Board of Regents and the university president, Clark Kerr. J. Edgar Hoover authorized this meeting. The agents talked to Reagan. At that time, Reagan had a bad cold. So when the agents went to the governor's mansion in Sacramento, they were surprised to be led into Ronald Reagan's bedroom, and they gave him the briefing as he was propped up in bed with a muffler around his throat. Well, Reagan was grateful for this information, and then 2 weeks later, at the first Board of Regents meeting he attended, the regents voted to fire Clark Kerr.
Talk a little bit about the FBI's help with the security clearance that Reagan needed as a member of that Board of Regents, which was part of what happened when he became governor.
Yes. Well, when Reagan became governor, he automatically became a member of the Board of Regents, ex officio. And in that capacity, he needed to have a security clearance because the Board of Regents oversees the university's nuclear weapons labs. As the first step in that process, Reagan filled out the mandatory personnel security questionnaire. This is a government form that asks people to list any subversive groups that they were involved in. Back in Hollywood in the 40s, Reagan had been involved in several liberal groups that the government officially classified as subversive organizations. But when he filled out this form under penalty of perjury, he failed to list these groups. When the FBI was doing the background check, they noticed this, but instead of pointing it out as would have been normal procedure, they helped Reagan cover up the fact that he had failed to comply with the form's requirements and had failed to list the subversive organizations he was involved in.
There's certainly no question that the degree to which the FBI helped Reagan had an impact on historical events, on partisan political events.
There's no doubt about that. In the years during the Cold War, J. Edgar Hoover's FBI attempted to manipulate the public's perception of events unfolding at the University of California. The FBI did this by leaking information to news reporters, by trying to alter the view that public officials had of the university, by sending anonymous letters, poison pen letters, and by attempting to disrupt and neutralize groups and people involved in lawful First Amendment activities. So in those years, Hoover's FBI tried to alter history, in a sense. And what I discovered during my lawsuits under the Freedom of Information Act was that the FBI, even now, is in effect attempting to manipulate our understanding of history by improperly withholding public information about that history.
You know, you talk about the briefing that the FBI gave Reagan after he had become governor, briefing about the Board of Regents and Clark Kerr. In fact, some of the information that had been passed on to Reagan was incorrect information. It was purposely falsified by the FBI.
J. Edgar Hoover's FBI often exaggerated the extent to which communists or alleged subversives were involved in protest activity. This was a way that Hoover could justify investigating these organizations. He would say that he was trying to uncover communist infiltration. And when Hoover gave reports about these various protest groups to Ronald Reagan, his agents once again exaggerated the extent to which communists and socialists were involved. At one point, during the free speech movement, FBI agents posed as news reporters and asked Mario Savio questions like, how many communists are involved in the free speech movement? Is it true the free speech movement is being manipulated by the communists? Hoover had hoped to taint the free speech movement by planting these questions. And as a result, newspapers around the country carried stories in which Mario Savio was quoted as denying that the communists had any special influence on the free speech movement. was another example of Hoover trying to manipulate the public's understanding of events at the University of California during the 60s.
What do we know about Hoover's opinion of Reagan in general, beyond the fact that he was a useful tool to Hoover?
At first, in the 1940s, J. Edgar Hoover and other FBI officials were suspicious of Ronald Reagan. Reagan had been involved in a number of liberal groups, and they didn't trust him. But after Reagan became an FBI informer and proved that he was committed to Hoover's war against communists, FBI officials gradually came to trust him and view him as a close and cooperative source. And by the time he became governor, J. Edgar Hoover viewed Ronald Reagan as a breath of fresh air. The FBI had become very frustrated with Governor Pat Brown because Pat Brown had refused to fire Clark Kerr. So when Reagan came along, Hoover thought he finally had an ally in the governor's office.
Seth Rosenfeld, the book is Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power. Seth, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.